Tasmād yasya maha bhāho
Nigrahītāni sarvaśaḥ
Nigrahītāni sarvaśaḥ
Indriyānindriyārthebhyaḥ
Tasya prajñā pratiṣṭhitā Tasmāt yasya Mahābāho nigrahītāni sarvaśaḥ indriyāni indriyārthebhyaḥ tasya prajñā pratiṣṭhitā. So Shankara introduces this verse saying, beginning with the verse Yataha, that begins with Yataha Yapi, which is way back, I mean, it's not way back, it's eight verses back. Beginning with that verse, he says, having explained that and given the upapatti, given the logic for it and the reasons for it in many different ways, so having told that, now he's going to upasamharati, conclude that section. And so all of these verses that we are really, they're raga-dvesha verses, you know. The kami means the one who has these raga-dveshas. For that person, it's very, very difficult to have any shanti. When the raga-dvesha is there, that mind does not have shanti. When there's no shanti, there's no ananda. You know? And so the neutralization of the raga dveshas through the prasada buddhi and everything that they've been teaching, that ability of the mind to let the ragas go, to be able to pull back the sense organs when they're getting involved, means when the mind has been triggered. Sense organs, remember, they're just reporters. But as they're, you know, moving about, something gets triggered, something lights up. And when it lights up, do I go with it? You know, do I go with it? Ah. And so the kama develops. Do I go with it, or do I have the freedom to not go with it? I have to have that freedom. I have to have the viveka. Is this something that I really want to get myself involved in? Or are the raga dveshas just going to pull me along with it? It's not so much that what we would say is the raga dveshas as binding desires I don't want. So if I feel that I'm getting hooked in that way, I need to have the freedom to pull my mind back. The freedom, the value, the viveka, the discrimination. Because just through experience and the assimilation of my experience, I realize it's just simply not worth it. It's not worth the price of my shanti. Right? And it is a big price that I'm paying. So more and more I recognize how big that price is. For nothing. Nothing in the sense that it doesn't own the ananda. The ananda is projected upon it. That is not the source of the ananda. And so why do I do this to my mind, get my mind into this agitated state and working for something which is not there? That's the thing. I need to have that viveka, though, that clarity, that what I'm working for doesn't exist there. So I need to go ahead and go with these things as non-binding desires, but not desires that are carrying with it this ajnanam-born projection. That's the problem. And so always I have to bring my mind back when it's a binding desire to kind of be with that and think about it, you know, and to remember, to bring my knowledge, you know, to the forefront, to do what, to go back inside of my own psyche to see what's really going on there, what it is that I actually want, you know. Because if you remember, I think to me this has always been helpful, this desire template, I want this so that I can be happy. That this can be replaced by anything in the universe that happens to strike your fancy, you know. The problem is that what you want is to be happy. It's not this that you want. That's why the happiness keeps dripping off the thing that you thought you loved. The reason you loved it, why? Because it makes me happy. As soon as it doesn't make you happy for that short period of time, it becomes a dvesha. What was a raga becomes a dvesha. It used to make me happy, now it's making me unhappy. That's dvesha. With dvesha, then I think I have to get away from that thing, which again is an illusion. Because the ananda doesn't exist out there, the cause for the dvesha doesn't exist out there either. And so this is what we've been working on, what Krishna's been saying over and over in many different ways for these last 8 verses or so. And so now he sums it up, and he says, Tasmat, therefore, he said, Yesya, for whom, hey Mahabaho. Mahabaho means the one who's very strong. You know, it's a name for Arjuna. One who has massive arms is what it actually says. He's got really massive arms. He's very strong. Maha means great, strong, you know, huge. And then the bahu is arms or strength also. So Mahabaho, Nigrahitani, Sarvashaha. Nigrahitani means indriyartebhyaha. The indriyas, the sense organs, indriyartebhyaha, from the sense objects. So these indriyas, the one for whom the indriyas are nigrahitani, means pulled back under my control. You know, if you say pulled back, how you want to think about that is really under my control. Means I have that option. I have that freedom, you know, to pull them back. And so chances are, if the desire or the fancy that has lit up is a binding desire, has the feeling of a binding desire, you'll say, oh no, I'm not going there. Or just no. No, thank you. No, thank you. Thank you. I really enjoy my own shanti, and I don't want to get involved in that projected ananda. So, pulls back. And wants to pull back. Sarvashaha, in all ways, at all times, you know. If there's not really a compromise there. If it's non-binding, we're not talking about that. Binding desires, it's the more you are with your own fullness, the more you don't want your mind running after these illusions, you know. Because that's what they are. They're illusions. There is no ananda there. I am the ananda. It's just also the mind gets lazy sometimes. You think, I know I'm really the ananda. I know that the ananda isn't really there. But when I said, sometimes it's, you know, it's easier just to satisfy the desire, even though you know the whole thing, to satisfy the desire so that you have that moment of happiness. Just relieve that pressure, relieve that stress. But the thing is, as your shanti increases with your knowledge, because knowledge itself does its work, you know, it does its work because more and more you understand at the time of teaching and in the guided meditations and whatnot, you see it more and more clearly that the source of ananda is the Atma, is my own being. And that affects your relationship with these binding desires. But then when I also bring in the prasada buddhi, I also have a value for pulling my mind back. And still, the mind, until the shanti, the natural shanti in your mind reaches a certain level, you know, you want a little bit more ananda in the mind. You know, just let me have this little breather, like that. You want a little bit more ananda in the mind. And so you find yourself running out after these things and getting involved and having all the sukha and dukkha and all of these things that stresses and strains that take place when you're engaged in the world in that way. And then you realize again, oh, that was a mistake. That was a little mistake. Okay. Let's keep it to non-binding desire. So you more and more are pulling your mind back simply because it's not worth it to you. It's not worth it. You love the shanti, you love the prasada of your own mind. It's so beautiful. And your own nature is also, you know, manifest in your mind. Your nature is there always, in experientially as you, because you are that conscious being, you are that wholeness. But the mind is doing this and that and this and that. Okay, you can have vairagya and You know, just let it be. But, you know, it's just like if your body is not well, you know, you want to care for it because it should be well. If you can possibly keep it well and healthy, you know, then you want to do that because it's just so much nicer, as long as you have a body, for it to be healthy. So you will have a perversity, an inclination. If you can't make it healthy, then it's a, that also becomes like a non-binding desire to keep the body healthy. You do what you can. If you're unable to, then you accept that. You know, it's the same with the mind. It's much nicer for the mind to be responding to your to the truth of your being, where the mind is a natural expression of who you are. Then the very way the mind is true to yourself, and you're very comfortable with it. It's a beautiful instrument. But when the ajnanam is there, or that knowledge has not really been assimilated, and all of these habits have not, we call, just habitual behaviors from beginningless time, and so they are quite well rooted. So these things, you know, I can accommodate them, and I can bring them back, and understand what's going on there and all of that. But you know, it's so much nicer when I'm just being myself and my mind has knowledge and it's an expression of that knowledge, and then all is not only well, all is really beautiful, all is Bhagavan, all is Ishwara. There are no real problems at all. The problems that there are just objective problems that we all have to deal with. But in terms of my ananda or my wholeness or my well-being, there's not a problem there. So what he says here, you know, kind of coming, bringing this to an end, he says, therefore, Arjuna, you know, for the one whose sense organs are under control in reference from the sense objects, are withdrawn, means they're not stuck. I can withdraw them at any time. So for such a person, he says, for that person, for him, tasya prajna pratishtita, his knowledge is steady. Remember when we say his knowledge is his knowledge or her knowledge is steady, you know, is firm, it means that the mind that was had ajnanam, had self-ignorance, now has knowledge, and that knowledge isn't bumped off all the time by the raga dvesha. The good thing is that when the knowledge is being kind of superseded by your raga dvesha, once your knowledge reaches a certain point, then the buddhi itself is very aware of what's going on. It's not like your knowledge is being bumped off, you're just not paying attention to it, in a sense. But the mind then is producing dukkha, you know, or stress. And so as soon as what happens for you, just giving you a little advance notice if this hasn't happened yet. This is an advance notice, okay. So as a little piece of stress comes up because of a binding desire, means there's something in me that wants this to be happy. I really need this to have a full, complete life. That little binding desire comes up, and you feel the first little twinge of stress. Your jnanam comes in and says, no, I'm not going there. Don't do it. Don't go there. Or I'm not going there. And lets it go. It doesn't even have to say that those words. When this type of avritti comes up, the mind just lets it go. This is called shama. You heard of this, you know, these sadhana chatushtaya, the fourfold qualities of somebody who's a mumukshu. The first one we've been through quite a bit is viveka and vairagya. Right? Without viveka, without recognizing that everything is finite, and so any pulla, any result that you get is bound by time. That's just how it is. There's not a thing you can do about it. So even if something does give you some sukha, that sukha will be temporary because there is no experience that I have that is not temporary, other than the self-evident being of myself. That is it. There's zero. And so once I realize that, this drive to become whole and complete by fulfilling myself, by fulfilling all of my desires, so I end up with exactly what I want, this urge or this natural inclination to become whole by fulfilling desires starts to really fall flat because you recognize that's not a possibility. And there's nothing you can do about it. If it's not a possibility, if it's not the nature of the creation itself, no matter how smart you are or how capable you are, how much money you have, it doesn't make any difference at all in terms of being able to accomplish that, because the creation is not that way. The creation, everything about it, including your body, mind, sense organs, is in constant change. Once you realize that, it's kind of the dark night of the soul, that mumukshutvam can rise up, you know. Or you might just become sour grapes and kill yourself, you know. That's novel. But it's pretty depressing, you know. But if you have shredded... If you have Shraddha, you know, and you say to Bhagavan, there must be, please teach me what, there must be a solution to this, because how can we all have this desire to be whole and complete? There must be a solution to this. So your mind withdraws from its energy for trying to produce something for myself that is not possible, and becomes a seeker, becomes a mumukshu. And then really looks up to Bhagavan and says something like, if you're there, you know, if you're there, please, please help me, please save me. You know, please, please show me the way. In some form, you will ask for that, because you've realized you don't know. You see there's no solution. And you even with all logic, there's no solution to this. And so Bhagavan has to give you the solution. If there is one, there's no way you can know about it. Because from all of your sense perception and all the means of knowledge you have at your disposal will only tell you that everything that you're experiencing is in constant flux and subject to continual birth and death on every level. And so therefore there is no lasting sukha, no lasting ananda, no lasting fullness, that if that fullness is given to me from the creation, including from my body, or from my mind, or from my sense organs, or from the objects that they perceive, right? Because also your mind is continually changing. Your body is continually changing. Birth and death, sense organs are continually changing. Even in the Katha Upanishad, when Lord Yama is trying to dissuade Nachiketas from really asking for self-knowledge, he offers him all kinds of goodies, everything that you could possibly, a person could possibly want. So just, you can have this, and you can have this, and you can have this, and you can have this. Isn't that wonderful? He said, these are just going to burn out my senses, and I'm going to die. He had viveka, you know. He didn't fall for it. He just remained very calm. And he said, no. I'm sitting before you. You're Lord Yama, the Lord of Death. You're the one person who can really be the best teacher for me to tell me what the truth of this whole thing is. He just stood firm. That's somebody who's assimilated the experience. So for such a person who has this advaita, this viveka, vairagya, and mumukshutvam, there's certain qualities in the mind that as you come to with the knowledge, but you also grow. You grow into these qualities. You already have enough qualities to have that viveka, that initial discrimination. But these qualities also grow. And the first one is called shama. Shama is, just imagine your mind being like this, because I would say probably 90% of the time your mind is like this, but that other 10% is formidable. It is that as the thoughts come, they go. You have the freedom for when a thought or an emotion arises to let it go. You don't need to go with it. That's shama. You have control, in a sense, over your mind's staying or leaving. The vritti, staying or leaving, that's shama. When the vritti, when the emotion or the experience stays, in spite of your probably wanting it to go, when it stays and you feel it's embodied, you know, dhamma is the ability to not act that out, Like, say somebody really makes you mad, and you have a lot of pressure inside just to let them have it verbally or physically or whatever ways, that pressure is inside, you know? But you have the ability to hold that pressure. And I would say even for us with the Dhamma, I have not only have the ability to hold the pressure or hold the anger or hold whatever the emotion is, I have the ability to hold it in a healing way. You know? It's not just for us anymore, it's not just hold it, like hold your breath. Or if you're really angry, take a walk. I mean, we tell clients to do this. When you're really angry, instead of acting out, go swimming, take a walk, hit a pillow, leave. Leave the scene for some time so that you don't act out from that pressure, because the pressure is really big. Pressure can be really strong. So for us, it's not about taking a walk, you know, beating a pillow and all of these things, even though they have their use. It's not that to negate them, but it's more about being able to be with that, hold it, you know, and say to him, what is really going on? You're so angry. What is it? And let the buddhi come in a healing way, you know, be a healing way and work with that emotion that you are not only willing to hold, but want to hold. You want to hold it so that you can process it, you know, and release that anger from where it's really originating. That's the thing. Instead of the projected anger, you go to the very source of the anger, the source of the raga. The source of the raga or the source of the dvesha. What is it really about? What is it that you really want? So that's the Dhamma. And so the upadati is sometimes in some of the shastras they talk about upadati as sannyasa. What it means just in modern parlance, it would just mean that I have the ability to stay with a given subject matter. So say if I'm interested in Vedanta, I'm not just a dilettante. Oh, let me study this for a few months, or my habit is to really get involved in something, study it, and then move on to the next thing, and then it just becomes one of many things. But the upadati is the sannyasa. Sannyasa means, not that I have to take sannyasa, but this is what is important to me, this is what I need to know. Okay? And I'm not wavering, I don't have any wavering. Swamiji talks about when he was a young Swami, actually. He must have been in his 20s. A young Swami. He had a beautiful voice, you know, and a natural, you know, he had a beautiful voice. It's wonderful. And he had that sense of music. And so he could just naturally sing and follow a raga according to the correct tala and all of that kind of stuff without even knowing very much about it or nothing about it at all. He knew the notes of the raga. But he could easily hold a raga, and also is very, very musically creative. A lot of songs would come to him and that type of thing. And so musicians wanted him to study music seriously, to really apply himself to music just because of his kind of God-given talent, including the very beautiful voice. And he loved music, too. And he loved singing bhajans. And I remember when I would go to Rishikesh, and we'd spend time in Rishikesh, Swamiji and some of the sadhus, they would have all these instruments. Like, they'd have these drums, like this kind of drum, and then this kind of drum that's like this with the ends. And that's the one Swamiji liked. And so they'd be playing these. They'd have these kind of different drum rattles and all kinds of instruments. And some would have a harmonium, would sometimes be there by somebody. So they would really sing. We'd have bhajans that were just beautiful, you know. Everybody would be playing. Sometimes they'd pass the instruments out, you know. But Swamiji would be singing. Sometimes they'd go for an hour or more just singing these beautiful, beautiful bhajans. So he loved singing. And so when that was offered to him by some renowned musicians, because they used to all come, which was something that we all enjoyed, actually, he was offered that, you know, and told you need to really study seriously. He thought about it. It was a little tempting. But he said no. Because he didn't want to divide up, you know, his time and his energy. So he just said no. And from that time, he kept singing, but just unlike we do when we're singing bhajans. You know, he had the natural capacity, so he sang these beautiful songs, but he gave up any real study of music other than maybe what we might do if you're not a musician. And just stayed, because he wanted to stay that upadati. He wanted to just keep his mind in this knowledge. And that's where he wanted to put his energy. That's upadati. So that he didn't want to divide it. I'm interested in this. Let me become a music mahatma. Let me become someone to become really a master of anything in India, they say 12 years. 12 years of committed study. And that only takes you to the first stage of mastery. You know, but 12 years of committed study. They've done studies on this also. They find that, yeah, 12 years of commitment will bring you to a certain level of mastery. And then, of course, that mastery keeps growing and growing and growing. And so it'd be hard to put in that commitment and put that commitment in somewhere else too. You know, and so he said, no, that's the upadati. So shama dhamma upadati titiksha. Titiksha, the fourth one, is because that upadati is there, the pairs of opposites, I can accommodate. Sometimes it's called endure. Well, I can endure the pairs of opposites. Endure has kind of a negative connotation, but if you think of it, accommodate. It's not like I'm asking the creation or the world to not have its opposites, you know, to only give the side of experience that is pleasing to me, you know. Like when I want it to snow in the winter so I can go skiing, it should snow, you know. And I want it to be warm in the summer, you know, so I can go swimming. It should be warm, you know. So that's really problematic, isn't it? It's really problematic. So what if I don't ask that of the universe? I'm fine. I can accommodate what Bhagavan gives. That's titiksha. It means my shanti is not disturbed by the opposites that come my way. It's fine. It's the nature of the creation. I don't ask for anything more. Titiksha samadhanam. Samadhanam is because I'm single-pointed. So these all hooked together. Because I'm single-pointed, my mind is available. You know, so I can then, my mind is available for this teaching. My mind is available for nididhyasana. My mind is available for satsang. My mind is available for doing this inner work, because all of this, you know, is that my focus is on exactly what I'm doing, which is gaining this knowledge. That's what's primary. It's not that we don't do a lot of other things, just like brushing our teeth or washing the dishes. I mean, there's so many other things, and we have to work for a living. Those are all so secondary, though. They're all sadhana. Someone asked me the other day, well, what really do you mean by sadhana? I thought that was a good question, actually. What do we mean when we say sadhana? How do you say it? Because you say everything else is a sadhana. What that means is that, because sadhana actually means the means for gaining antakarana shuddhi. So like, for instance, I gave the example, Swamiji's given the example, like if I want to go to town, how am I going to get there? What is the means for getting me there? Am I going to ride my bike? Am I going to jog? Am I going to take a car? Whatever means I use, that is the sadhana for getting me to town. So the sadhana is the means that is required for reaching my destination. So here my destination, you know, is antakarana shuddhi, which then allows really for jnana nishtha, for this, you know. So how do we say that the samsara, or everything I find myself doing, it is this, my sadhana. It is this. That either in your experience, everything, the things are just neutral and shine as Bhagavan, because there's no raga dvesha there to disrupt that, you know. But when a raga dvesha arises, and that comes in many forms, like for instance, I don't like this person, or this is really, really hard, or whatever it happens to be, I wish that this situation hadn't come. Those are all raga. They're all raga dveshas. Yeah. And so that person, that situation, that object, that job, whatever it is, it is my sadhana, in the sense that now this represents something for me to use to neutralize my raga dvesha. This becomes the sadhana. This is that becomes the thing that I'm applying my skills to, applying my knowledge to, so that I can will help me overcome this raga dvesha. So the whole world we use as a either everything is fine, no sadhana necessary, everything is fine, but then whenever there's a problem, it's not that I'm, you know, acting out on that problem. You can even thank Bhagawan for that problem, because it's there. If it's there, it's there, you know. So, okay, this has come up as something for me to neutralize. So in reference to this kind of a problem or this particular person, let me be free. Let my relationship with that person or that situation not disturb my shanti at all. You know? So let that be a sadhana. And that attitude is so beautiful. It's not that anybody even has to know. They won't know because you're not acting out. But they're a valuable person for you. It's a valuable situation. And that's why Swamiji said, you know, you can't leave your job until you work that out with that guy. Yeah. I'm glad I did that. Yeah. Little reminder, just gives little reminders. Oh, sorry. Let it be a sadhana. So that is what it's meant there. So then comes the shraddha. So shama dhamma upariti titiksha samadhanam shraddha. Sometimes shraddha is put last. The most important is always last. And shraddha, the sixth qualification, has to do with my mind's openness and willingness to learn from this particular teaching. And from this particular teaching, it's the acharya and the upadesha. Shraddha, vishwasa, means a certain faith, shraddha, in the acharya, the teacher, and the upadesha, the teaching. Because otherwise, my psyche is not available. And I need my mind needs to be completely, have that shantavritti, and completely available to this vision, so that when it's taking place, in the teacher's mind, the student is seeing it. It's like there's only one mind there, you know. And then when the class is over, you go with your mind and I go with mine. But while the teaching is taking place, if that shanti is there with no bad feelings between the teacher and student, and if I have that shanti and I'm not being plagued by emotional problems or hurts inside or raga dveshas, my mind is just there present. There, I have that shraddha, which means I'm open to receiving that knowledge, and then I'm open to asking all kinds of questions about it and say, well, what about this and what about this and what about this? For clarity, for my clarity. That's why I want to know. Yeah, all of my doubts need to be resolved. So because I have that shraddha in that knowledge, means Swamiji also defined shraddha, faith pending understanding. It's not faith, then you'll check it out if it's true when you die and go to heaven. That's different. This means faith in the sense of my mind is available, you know, and pending and has that shraddha, which will resolve into my understanding. Why shraddha is necessary? Shraddha is necessary because I don't know what the teacher knows. And so if we're talking about moksha, or liberation, or freedom from suffering, enlightenment, I don't have that experience yet. I don't know what it is. And so that you have shraddha in, say, the Upanishads or the Vedanta, and in the teacher, they say that is Ishwara Nugraha. That's just the grace of God, because you really have no way of knowing until you yourself know. That's the idea. So shraddha is considered a blessing. And it's also, with shraddha and this teaching, what they say is that when a person is a mumukshu, the promise of the shastra is when a person is truly a mumukshu, means that they are asking the proper questions. Let me be, not, unlike like, let me be be liberated, I need to be able to astral travel and then everything will be fine. Or let me be liberated, I need to be able to sit in nirvikalpa samadhi and then I will be whole. So you already have some idea of what you want. But when the mumukshutvam has to do with really the recognition of the problem that we're facing, you know, and then seeking to know myself, to know what the truth of things are, then you will meet your teacher. So that's the promise of the Shastra. Why I decided to bring this up right now, because it's just part of the thing, is that that gives you the freedom to not worry about all of the other crazy things that are going on in the world. There's a lot of, there's a lot of funny, there's a lot of very funny ideas, and there's a lot of very funny definitions of moksha. And there's a lot of things that are not going to bear fruit. You know? And then people are trapped in that. You know, that it's not going to bear fruit. They're committed to it. They're trapped in it. But it may bear the fruit of what they're looking for. You know, it may, what they think is moksha, it may bear fruit in that way. You know, and so they have shraddha on that particular teacher to give what they believe, what is their definition of moksha or liberation. And then when they get it, they'll realize, you know, if it's not real, they'll realize that, you know, like that student who got that Shaktipat, is, wow. Unlike me, when I was listening to Swamiji and everything was completely clear, and I thought, wow, I am liberated, you know, because I didn't know, you know. Fortunately, he was the real deal. But I'm saying is that you may get the results of what that teacher is teaching, because many of them are very, very serious, so you get the results of that, but that won't be the moksha you're looking for because the result is time-bound. But eventually, you will realize that there is no result that you can attain that stays within subject-object. I'm attaining this now, and I didn't have it before. You are within time, right? And so that may be useful. It may have good qualities and nice things and all of that, but it is still time-bound, and you still won't feel free. You still won't be whole. You won't be able to say, I've done everything that is to be done, and all is well. Nothing can shake that. Nothing can touch it. Nothing can touch my being. That won't take place. And so then you'll just be on the circuit again, praying to Bhagawan. Maybe this time with a question that's more related to the moksha that the Upanishads has for its top pariya. So in that way, there's nothing to worry about. You don't have to be saviors. You don't have to be saviors, because a person, when the person is ready, they get what they need. And that's also part of the vision. And it gives so much freedom, and you can see it in your own life. The Bhagavan gives you what you need when you need it. And what you need at a given time may not be moksha, because that's not what you're seeking. That's not what you're looking for. But when you're ready for that, then you will get that. So I think that's beautiful. So, so here, again, having, he says, that prajna pratishtita is really, hey Mahabaho, the person, he says, the person who has this ability to hold the sense organs, you know, and neutralize the raga dvesha before it takes off. You have that freedom to hold it. That person has steady wisdom. Because there's no doubt, there's nobody in their role in this, I want that, you know. What about when the mind just says, no, I don't want that. I don't want it because it doesn't bear me any fruit. And so I'm just able to hold myself steady, have my non-binding desires that don't rattle the shantavritti of myself. Does it fall for the raga dvesha? And then live my life with the knowledge that is firm. So then, thinking that maybe there's more to explain about this, he wants to give an example. Okay, so let's do that next verse.
Yanisha sarva bhutanam.
Tasyan
jagrati samyami.
Yasyan jagrati bhutani.
Yasyan jagrati bhutani.
Sanisha pashyato munehe.
Sanisha pashyato munehe.
Ya nisha sarva bhutanam. Tasyam jagrati samyami. Yasyam jagrati bhutani sa nisha pashyataha munehe. He says, that which is yanisha, nominative, yanisha, that which is night, nighttime, sarva bhutanam, for all beings, so that which is night for all beings, tasyam, for the one, for the samyami, it says the samyami means the one who has control of their raga dveshas, being having this jnanam, knowledge, and having control of their raga dveshas. Yam means to be able to control. And with the sam means completely. So it's for the jivan mukta, for the jnani. Jnani has completely that control. Because there's no, that antakarna shuddhi is there, the prasada buddhi has kind of... the knowledge has really manifested clearly in that mind that has the prasada buddhi, so that one has that complete control and nivritti from what we call binding raga dveshas. So it says, that which is night for all beings, the samyami, the jnani, is jagarti, awake in that. So what is night for all beings? In that condition, in that state, the jnani is wide awake. Okay? And it says, yasyam jagrati bhutani, in which the beings, bhutani, jagrati, are awake. That which in which the bhutas, the beings, are awake, sa nisha pashataha munehe. That is night for the muni who sees. So it's just that this verse is quoted all the time. You know, if I were to go through all the Bhagavad Gita and picked out, there's probably 10 or 15 verses that it'd be kind of nice to memorize. They're the ones that Swamiji rattles off over and over and over again and that are so famous in the Bhagavad Gita. This one is like that. And so in this verse, what it's basically saying, what is night for the jnani is day for the ajnani, and what is day for the jnani is night for the ajnani. That's the verse, basically. And so think of nighttime as ajnanam, the darkness of ajnanam. And so for a person who is suffering from ajnanam, that person from self-ignorance, that person is not going to see what the person who has self-knowledge sees. Not at all. It's absolute opposite. And why Bhagavan maybe brings this verse up here now, because we only have like three more verses, I think. Two more after this one. One, two, three more verses for this chapter. Right? So this is kind of an important verse to bring up right now, because if you remember Arjuna's question, that please tell me, give me the characteristics of a wise person. How do they walk? How do they talk? You know, how do they sit? In other words, tell me whatever you can to describe a wise person. You know, and so Krishna understands the spirit of his question, but he can't really describe what it is like to be a wise person, because to be a jnani, to have self-knowledge, because you're still living within the darkness of ajnanam. So you can't really know that. And so what he spent this whole time doing, from I guess verse 54, is talking about the characteristics in terms of dharma, in terms of raga dvesha, in terms of prasada buddhi, you know, so that I kind of understand the way that a wise man experiences the world, you know, and how to bring your sense organs in so you have that prasada buddhi, so that you have that shantavritti. And so describing the wise man in terms of the values, the way he or she is with the world, the way he or she is with the neutralization of the raga dveshas, but in terms of really understanding the tremendous freedom of the wise person, because it goes beyond just the prasada buddhi, which allows the prasada buddhi accepts the kartritvam, the sense of doership, right? So there's still ajnanam there, but the person is a mumukshu and gaining knowledge, but this sense of, I am doing this, you know, how do I neutralize my raga dveshas, you know? The kartritvam there's doership there. I have to do this, I have to do this. I have to have a prasada buddhi. Let me accept all of my experiences, you know, with that Ishvara Arpana buddhi, everything is a worship to Bhagavan. I accept everything as prasada. So for me, until that knowledge really takes place, they still have the doership. Because even as a mamukshu, I want self-knowledge, you know. So that kartritvam, that doership is still there. And so that, with that doership there, let me be a person who follows Dharma, you know, where Dharma becomes primary, who neutralizes the raga dveshas by accepting everything with that as prasada buddhi, and seeing all my actions. This is karta means the doer, accepting all, having all of my actions be seen, all of my actions as a worship, as an arpana, as an offering to Bhagavan, and receiving all of the results, everything that comes my way with that prasada buddhi. So that, even though the kartritvam is still there, I'm a mumkshu, I'm gaining this knowledge, but that kartritvam really only resolves when my knowledge is complete, you know. But, so you say that all of those ways of bringing the mind to that prasada buddhi, you know, and prasada means that Ishwara's grace, that beautiful and buddhi. He describes, so Krishna describes all of that, and Arjuna was hoping in another thing, as Swamiji says, that he was asking Krishna this because he wanted to imitate him, copy him as a role model. Tell me how I should act, and tell me how I should be. And the thing is that's a very beautiful question, because let me follow in your footsteps. Let me behave as you behave. But for me, it's a sadhana. For you, it's absolutely natural. For instance, when we talk about what are the natural values of you when you're not upset, you know, when there's no raga dvesha, you know, when there's no reactions, just me, then these beautiful values like compassion and love and care and, you know, wanting to help, just these, the positive spectrum of values are my values. It's only when there's some raga dvesha that's tormenting my mind in one way or another, bringing in that agitation, that these values get pushed to the side, because I'm now projected out there and that becomes primary. And so then sometimes Dharma is put to the side, a Dharma comes in, my shanti is put to the side, my reactions take place because my focus, my love, my passion is on that object. And so these beautiful values, which I know so well and have experienced in myself so many times, are not just the natural expression that I can count on. But for Ajnani, they are. Those are the values. Because anything that comes up as a desire is going to be non-binding. Be very hard for a jnani who is really has clarity and has time to be with this knowledge to have a binding desire. Because as soon as the binding desire comes up, you let it go because you don't want to deal with it. It's too much work. It's too much agitation. It's fruitless. I would much rather, there's no, much rather means there's no comparison. There's nothing in me or in the jnani who wants to get involved in samsara again. When I can just be here with Ishvara and watch the life unfold and see what Bhagavan brings and be kind of interested and excited about that and doing my part in life, in my life as it unfolds. That's the life of a jnani. Like Swamiji says, I just do what's there before me to be done to the best of my ability. That's also natural to you. You know, let me do this to the worst of my ability. We don't think like that, you know. But if there's nothing pulling at me, then naturally I do whatever it is to be done. I do it in the best that I can, you know. What is there to be done? And Swamiji talks when he was taught. I mean, I'll never forget this because it just seared into my mind. It just completed something, some understanding for me when that the truth of it. And he just said it so naturally, and then he says, and that's it, that's all. That's a big thing for him to say, for anybody to say. I just am here. I do it, Bhagavan. What comes? It's Ishvara. I just do what is here, the best of my ability, day after day after day. That is it. And that's as you let go of these raga dveshas, there's a lot of repercussions. When you let go of the raga dveshas, then what you have is fine. That means what is here right now is fine. Because I'm not chasing after raga dveshas. I need this to be happy, I need that to be happy. I'm not dealing with that at all. They've just fallen to the wayside. And then that means that if the raga dveshas aren't there, then I am here. And the source of ananda isn't projected out. So I am here happily with myself, being with my prarabdha karma, being with my life. And that is it. Then every moment, the thing is we think that we have to create the moments. I have to create the next moment. And you don't create any moment. You're always responding to the moment. From the time you're born, the moment is already there. You're one step behind the moment. From the time you're born, you're one step behind the moment. That's an important thing. That means really, you are responding to the moment, right? You're not creating it. And so let me continue to respond to the moment, respond to Bhagavan. It has nothing to do with raga dvesha. So that's the life of a jnani. Now, that will goes even farther. You know, that's what you start to realize. But then what happens is that actually this is Ishvara. This body is part and parcel of Ishvara, so it is Ishvara also, right? Because it's like in the dream character, you don't say that in the dream world, you don't say the whole thing is the dream except for me, the character in it. No. The character is as much the dream as everything else in the dream, right? It's not like it has any special status. It belongs to the Ishvara of the dream. It belongs to the whole. So this belongs to Bhagavan. Is part and parcel of Bhagavan. Your mind and your sense organs belong to Bhagavan. They're not your subjective creation. They belong to Bhagavan. All of your thoughts and vrittis all belong to Bhagavan, because without Bhagavan you wouldn't be able to have thoughts and vrittis. All of these things. So there is really nothing about your body, mind, sense organs or what is being produced out of them that isn't Bhagavan. Because wait a minute, what's produced out of them, that's Jiva Srishti. Right? That's Jiva Srishti. But the body-mind sense organs that is allowing for that Jiva Srishti is only Bhagavan. Right? These things couldn't, without the laws of Ishvara and without the body-mind sense organs, there would be no Jiva Srishti. So Jiva Srishti is not separate from Bhagavan. It is also Ishvara. But the source of it is the body-mind sense organs, which belongs to Bhagavan. So Bhagavan's body-mind sense organs is producing these moods, emotions, vrittis, based upon whatever ajnanam is there in that body-mind sense organ. So the ajnanam belongs to Bhagavan, the subjective ajnanam, and the misconstrued notions, whatever is happening, it all fits very well into the network. There's not one part of it, one piece of it that's free from Bhagavan. And so then what happens, okay, I get that, so all of this belongs to Bhagavan. But what about me? I, what about me? Who does that belong to? Well, there's only one, so that's a good question. This Atma, this self that I am, is the very self of Bhagawan, is the self of the mosquito, is the self of Swiya and of Charlie and all of our wonderful little animals. You all have just the one self. The self doesn't belong to anyone. The self is non-dual. The self that I am is me, but there's only one me. And that me is who? Is it you, or is it me, or is it you? You know? Or does it belong to an animal? Who does it belong to? Does it belong to Ishwara? It doesn't even belong to Ishwara. It doesn't belong. It's the only thing that is here. Right? It's the only thing that is here. The whole creation, the whole Maya, Upadi, which you say, my being plus this creation, accepting the creation as being here, it's like accepting the pot being there in the clay, accepting this whole creation, we say Ishwara. But I am the very being of Ishwara, so there's no me who is Ishwara and me who is me and me who is you. There is only me who is the self of the whole creation. So now where is the karta? Who is the karta? And we have to say the karta, if you want there to be a karta, it has to be Ishwara, because there's nothing that isn't Ishwara. And if you go to your own being, there is no karta. Right? There's just conscious being in me. Om Tat Sat. We have to continue this. Next Yeah. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.